Another week of your adventures online has passed, so it must be time for Pods and Blogs. I'm Jamila, and this week we're going to take a brief look at accessibility online and have a chat with an alternative unconference organiser. But first, we return to Haiti. A lot of hard work continues in the capital and beyond as people try to regain some sense of normality following the earthquake. Georgia Popplewell, the managing director of Global Voices, went out to spend some time in Haiti, writing up her observations across a blog and on her Twitter account. She's come home again and took a moment to tell me about what she saw.
I went to Haiti with the main goal of seeing how Global Voices could support unprecedented citizen media activity that was started up as a result of the earthquake. Haiti's always been one of the countries that we found very difficult to cover at Global Voices because we focus on citizen media, and there's never really been much of a consistent citizen media level of activity there. After the earthquake, a number of people were tweeting, blogging, and we also saw the tools like Twitter being used in unprecedented ways in the relief and rescue efforts. I went just to see how we could help that to continue throughout the recovery and reconstruction stages. The exciting times in the media is the point when there's lots of, you know, blood and gore. Bodies and whatnot to report on, and the less sexy stage is when, you know, the real kind of hard work begins of figuring out how to deal with displaced people and how to rebuild, and those are really the important, you know, things to watch, because you have issues of transparency that come up. Haiti is a country that has not had a good history as far as foreign intervention or intervention by its own kind of government, and there's a lot of money being pumped into the country both by government and by relief agencies through donations. So it's really a time that I think the scrutiny needs to be kind of really, really on the country and what's going on there.
And do you feel that new media tools are going to affect that? Are people actually putting the work in to try and monitor this?
I think they can. What has happened is we found that, like, kind of drop off in the amount of activity, of course, because people are, in addition to just kind of the fact that the exciting part is over, a lot of people who were involved in the media activity are now kind of helping out. They're actually doing some heavy lifting. But I think that with some training and with getting the skills into the hands of certain critical groups, there can be some oversight from ordinary citizens.
There seem to be a great many transplants to Haiti who were talking to us at the time, but actually finding engaged Haitian voices who were already established online, that was a lot trickier. Do you think the activity that's happened because of this might change the way people look at that?
I'm hoping it does. The thing about Haiti is that it's not the most wired country in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, internet access is sporadic. Electricity supply, the electricity supply, even before the earthquake, was pretty sporadic. I mean, everybody has to depend on generators and things like that. So I think the internet wasn't always a kind of priority for some people. Some of the established groups also are run by a generation of people who aren't necessarily that kind of aware or have that much kind of faith in these tools. So yeah, I think there's a good reason that we aren't hearing the Haitian voices. Also, I mean, people in Haiti, if you were there for the earthquake, you have probably experienced a tremendous loss of property, loved ones.
Mm.
And I don't think I met anybody who had not lost someone or their home or had some kind of trauma.
Do you think when it comes to things like reporting from disasters that there's kind of a PR problem with things like Twitter? I mean, there is still a vast amount of people who consider it to be the place where people talk about the fact they're having a cheese sandwich.
Yes, exactly. As in other instances like Iran, for instance, the people who are on Twitter are, you know, it's a particular group. I think that there are probably still a lot of people in Haiti who just didn't know the Twitter thing happened. Certainly the poor people in Haiti, which is a, you know, vast number of people, the people who were displaced, probably have no clue that there was this conversation that was taking place. Because, you know, it's a terribly divided country in terms of, you know, class and wealth and whatnot. So people who are currently in camps, you know, the displaced are, yes, they have radios, and yes, there's some very good work going on, you know, using radios, and they've distributed crank radios that can operate without electricity. There is a divide, and any kind of work that's going to be done there, you're going to have to start with people who are already at least aware of, you know, IT and things like that.
Well, well, a place to start for us is probably your reports online from Haiti, which are outstanding. What's the URL and where can we find you online?
You can find us online at globalvoicesonline.org. And if you go to our homepage, we've got a section called Special Coverage, and the Haiti earthquake page is there. It's a tremendous amount. And I have to thank the incredible team that we put together. The Caribbean team is very small. It's really only about 3 or 4 of us. But we were joined by a couple of other people in the Global Voices community. From what people were saying, to have a capital city experience this kind of devastation in modern times is unprecedented. It's unbelievable. I really hope this is a chance for a country that really has just suffered too much.
Now, you may well have heard of the rather fantastic TED conferences with great choices to speak of creative things. You can watch their lectures and videos on YouTube and on their site. But many of us cannot actually make it to these gatherings. Due to this fact, Bill was initiated to run alongside TED, and both are coming up on your calendar very soon. Bill Erickson is one of the founders of the Bill Conference, and he told me about what's happening.
TED is an amazing conference that many of us want to go to, but we either can't get a ticket to it, or even if we could, we wouldn't be able to afford the $6,000 price. Mm-hmm. So a few of my friends decided we wanted to go hang out in Monterey around TED while it was going on and hopefully meet some interesting people. While we were planning our trip out there, we were deciding, what are we going to do during the day while they're in conference? So we decided to rent out a space nearby for a bunch of the other TED crashers to gather, and that's sort of how Bill started. It's very organic, unconference-y. The first year was organized all via a wiki by anyone who wanted to contribute, and it's just a very interesting alternative. While a conference like TED and most conferences are very structured and top-down, Bill's very organic and bottom-up.
If people are comparing the two, though, I mean, TED has a lot of high-production, high-value guests. You know, it's very rich, and they give their videos away as well. What sort of output does Bill have?
Because of its location to TED, we're lucky enough to get quite a few TED speakers every year, and then we also get some TED attendees. But more so, we get more of a community discussion, where TED is one person standing on stage in front of 1,000 people. Mm. Bill is more of a sort of a collaborative discussion where an interesting speaker gets up and starts a discussion, but then there's about 50 people to 100 people contributing and just keeping the discussion going. So while TED is very one-to-many, Bill is more many-to-many.
And how much does it cost then to turn up at Bill?
Bill is completely free.
Wow. So how do you manage numbers?
Well, it's sort of under the radar. We have a website that's not very informative, and it's a wiki. So it's mostly friends of friends and people who hear about it the week of. Basically, if you show up in time, then you can get in. If you don't, just hang out around outside. So our first year, our venue held 150 people, and we had about 250 show up. So almost half the talks were given outside, which was in the beautiful Monterey with this beautiful beach. So it was a great venue for that. We usually get venues that we think will be bigger than we need, but if we do run over, we just have things going around outside.
For anybody who's possibly missed the not-so-subtle joke, why is it called Bill?
Well, it's a play on Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. And while TED stands for Technology, Entertainment, and Design, Bill doesn't really have a name. It stands for whatever you want it to be. So when you go to the Bill website, BILconference.com, we have a list of like 10 or 20 words that start with B, I, and L, and a new conference name is randomly generated every time.
The topic is spread, though, hasn't it? In the way that TED has different flavors of their conferences, Bill's following in suit.
Well, TED is very global in reach, where a bunch of people fly in from all around the world to attend TED. Bill is more local, where most of the attendees at the Bill in Long Beach next to TED will be people in California. Most of the attendees at Bill Pill were people in San Diego, which was next to TEDMED. So we find that a lot of people are organizing Bills, and they're doing it based on whatever their local community wants to talk about. So while San Diego was medical-focused, that's what the local community there was. And so in Phoenix, Arizona, there was a sustainability bill called Sustainabill, because that's what the local community wanted to discuss.
More excitingly, for those of us who are in the UK, we may be looking at an international bill.
Bill UK is being organized, and it's going to be 16th and 17th of July, or right after TED Global. And the website describes it as a collection of events, workshops, and talks, and other fun stuff under the Bill banner for the weekend following TED Global.
Just remind us one more time where we need to go if we want to find out some more.
It is BillConference.com, BILConference.com.
I've been taking a look at accessibility online and how we can make the web better for people who may be sight impaired, unable to use a keyboard, or maybe cannot hear. These are things that most of us take for granted when we're online. So what are the ways in which this can change? Arthur Ortega is the accessibility evangelist for Yahoo Europe. He has been speaking all over the world and more recently in Geneva to the UN. He took a moment out of his schedule to explain how access can be improved.
I think education is the key point. Sometimes there are misperceptions about accessibility. There's still this sentiment that a lot of people think accessible pages are grey and not fancy enough and not interactive. There's a misperception that they think that JavaScript doesn't work with accessible technology, with screen readers and so on. Mm-hmm. But that's not really true. And the most important part is really to show them that accessibility can be very, very nice, very fancy and really interactive and having the latest Ajax features with rounded corners and all the fancy whistles, but they have to know how to do it. And I think education is the key factor to explain them what's possible and how to achieve it and how to change their mindset on finding solutions that makes pages accessible. So really a mind shift to say, how do I find a solution that is working as well for someone who can't move their hands and want to use the page, or someone who is deaf and wants to listen to a political debate on a video stream, and what are the challenges they are getting and how to solve them.
Do you think in a time where there's a lot of user-generated content online, so people, you know, making things for themselves, posting stuff all over the place and making their blogs, do you think it's easy for people to learn things that would help generally with accessibility?
The interesting thing at the moment is that a lot of open source projects are having accessibility in mind, or at least changing their default settings to a way that accessibility almost can come for free, so like WordPress, Drupal, and so on. They are already using default templates that provide information in a fairly good, accessible way without the need that someone has to learn about accessibility. This accessible content management systems that are providing the information in an accessible way, but as well opening the world for people that are disabled to contribute, to exchange information, to get political messages out, and having a huge interaction. I noticed that, for example, the deaf communities have using Twitter very strongly because it's an easy way to spread information. It's a very simple and deep way to consume information, and the users of Twitter are forced to provide it in a very short and understandable way, in a way that everyone is able to consume the information very, very fast.
Is it possible to speculate how much of the web is actually accessible to everyone? I mean, are we winning this battle, or is it still a bit slow?
It's a little bit divided. I think a lot of official governmental pages are getting better. They are opting in to make things accessible, especially with the new UN Convention on People with Disabilities, and basically the human rights of people with disabilities, and a lot of countries are ratifying these laws. The European Union and the European Commission are quite keen on adopting the UN Convention, and part of it, so basically Article 9 is about the web and the IT information in general, and this part is where really asks for making reasonable adjustments to making things accessible, the web page accessible, not even only the pages by the government, but by private companies as well. And this is, I think, a huge shift to say not only governmental information has to be accessible, but to provide access to pages where you can buy things, any kind of doing internet banking and so on, where you can take part on the regular life and take advantage of offers that are done online. And at the moment, it's quite a battle to being able to use sites provided by private companies.
I'm aware that you travel all over the world for your expertise, which is brilliant, and also explain quite a lot online as you're on your way. What's the best way to keep up with your activities?
Probably follow me on Twitter. My Twitter username is designedbyblind, in one word.
There are many brilliant people working on innovative ways to make the web accessible. Able-bodied users might not even be aware of the simple changes that make a real difference for so many others. On my travels looking at this subject, I came across an entertaining podcast by Dennis Lembry. It includes interesting observations on social media trends, as well as other general good ideas. He told me how he came to make the podcast and develop his site.
I had a friend a while back who got interested in podcasts. he'd found a small and growing group called the Detroit Podcasters Network. So I just went with him to a meeting one day and thought it was neat. And I thought, you know, if I did a podcast, what could I talk about? And I thought web accessibility was an important topic, and it was something that I knew a pretty good amount about. So I just went for it and tried it, and it just kind of took off, and it's been growing pretty steadily ever since.
The treatment of your site, as it's about web accessibility, I'm guessing that it must be full of whistles and bells for all sorts of accessibility.
It's actually still on the Blogger network. The first, you know, maybe year, I just used one of the standard templates. But then once it started growing, and I decided, you know, this is something that I want to do consistently, and I created my own custom Blogger template. And that, yeah, obviously is designed for web accessibility, so the default text is not real large, but, you know, at least is larger than most sites, I guess. Mm-hmm. And it has real clear headings that are marked up in the code, you know, as headings, which a lot of sites fail to do, unfortunately. But one of the challenges with doing it is transcribing. So, I mean, I do this as a hobby, and then lately I've gotten more requests for transcription, so I've been trying to find different avenues to do that. I'll take volunteers if somebody wants to volunteer, you know, maybe choose one podcast and transcribe, coordinate with me. Mm-hmm. So I've gotten a couple volunteers off Twitter for that, so that's good.
That's pretty good.
And I'm in the middle of transcribing one myself, so.
I believe certainly that it's all to the poor as well when it comes to social media, because there will be a section of people that I might not necessarily meet in all of the places that I go to online, where I'm used to sharing with, well, everyone, really.
Social media, yeah, does have accessibility issues also, and, you know, there has been an outcry and there has been studies done on it. One thing that I've done to help in the last year, I put out accessibletwitter.com. Twitter is, and other sites, you know, are somewhat accessible, but to make them more accessible and to make sites like this much easier to use, I created a site, accessibletwitter.com, and I'd like to say it's 100% accessible. It has a larger font size, uses headings appropriately. The color contrast, the ratio of color contrast is high, so people with low vision have easier time to distinct the colors. So accessible Twitter, yeah, it uses web standards and everything, so the code is real light and it could be accessed, you know, even by a mobile device such as an iPhone, you know, really easily. And it even works with a text-only browser, like Links. I've had a comment on Twitter from somebody using the Links text-only browser on accessible Twitter. So it really can, and yeah, people with, well, not only Braille or screen readers, but Braille output devices and everything work real well with the site.
Fantastic. What's your URL?
Oh, there's always DennisLembry.com, and then there's AccessibleTwitter.com, and then the WebAx podcast and blog is WebAx, WebAx.blogspot.com.
You may have seen some brilliant work on the BBC News website during the week relating to blind photographers. Being online should not just be about accessibility, of course, but also about enabling all of us to do something great or share something good when we get there. Vince Thacker is a blind photographer who posts his images online. He told me about the process.
I was registered blind about 5 years ago, and that was quite an important kind of event in my life. Soon after that, it hit me in the face that one thing I could do was, even if my eyes didn't work, the camera still did. And so I hit on photography as a possible means of seeing what I couldn't see very well by ordinary sight.
Mm-hmm.
People think it's a bit sort of weird and spurious, being a blind photographer. What on earth is that about? But it makes perfect sense to me.
In which case then, for those of us who are questioning how that might work, how do you take photographs then if you maybe can't see in the way that most people do?
Okay. Classic example was this. I walked up to the entrance to my local park, and it's the entrance is at the top of a slope that leads down to the river. Mm-hmm. I was standing on top of this slope, and there before me was a perfect stereo sound picture. Flock of birds over the river. I could tell exactly where they were. I could sense their movements from there, and so knew pretty well how to centralise the camera in the middle of them. I got a clue about the light as well from a bit of feeble winter sun, which was still a little bit warm on the side of my face.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did get a pretty vivid picture about what was going on, even if my sight wasn't providing all the data. And it did actually work very well. It's a fairly well-balanced picture, actually. I was really pleased with that one. It's not always as clear as that, but nonetheless, I can point the camera at something that I can't really make out very well, and at least I'll find out later what it was.
It sounds as though you're using senses in a way that, A, most of us take for granted, and B, might not actually think about referencing when we're taking our own photos.
That's right. Hmm. And in fact, I notice that some people on photography courses now do actually use blind photography techniques. They're actually using cameras with blocked-off viewfinders and this sort of thing. And they learn to use their other senses because they're also blindfolded. They have to use their other senses to make sense of their environment. You know, generally speaking, if you've got sight, I think most people would find that the sight takes priority.
It sounds like it's almost the noisiest sense, the one that we look for most.
Yeah, well, it's the one that clamours for priority. I mean, you've got about 30 centres in the brain to deal with vision, not all of it via the eyes.
Mm-hmm.
Some of it is to do with sort of images you might get in dreams or meditations or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But nonetheless, they're a very powerful set of centres in the brain that deal with these things.
Now, I've been browsing your photography online, which is rather beautiful.
Oh, thank you.
How did you know when this had worked? Did you run it by somebody else and say, well, look, you know, am I actually doing a good job of this? Is it working out? Because there's obviously a difference in quality of photographs. Some are standard and some are outstanding, and a lot of yours are outstanding.
Well, thank you. Well, I don't know about that, but I've given people plenty of chance to look at them, really, because I've put them on Flickr. And I've put them as slideshows on YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm always pleased to get feedback about what they are like, actually. And there are people around me who are prepared to let me bore them to tears, sitting them down to watch my latest slideshow. it does seem that people seem to think I've got some sort of knack.
And is there a network of people who work in the same way?
There is.
Mm-hmm.
I could mention particularly a site called blindphotographers.org.
Mm-hmm.
And that's wonderful. And not only is Tim, who set it up, Tim O'Brien, a photographer in his own right, of some clout, you know, he's worked for newspapers and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But he also writes articles that are extremely informative as well and encourages the rest of us who are members to do so.
Mm-hmm.
And there's quite a lot of description on that site about from us personally about how we set about doing our photography.
I certainly recommend coming to have a look at your photographs, but I'm going to ask you, where can we best find you online so that we can enjoy more of your photography?
The easiest way, I guess, is to have a look at the slideshows on YouTube. And if you go to YouTube and just look for me by ID, which is Visigoth999, and that will give you a page with a list of the videos, which are actually slideshows. They're not proper videos, but never mind. That may come as well.
Well, I know I learned a lot this week, but then I learn a lot every week making pods and blogs, mostly because there are so many great stories online that guide me. As usual, if you are up to something interesting online, or if you've seen something we should definitely be exploring, then drop me a line. You can email me at podsandblogs@bbc.co.uk, or come and say hello on Twitter, where we are always Pods and Blogs.